Hello and welcome to the Scholar's Circle, scholarscircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, we continue to trace the birth of free speech protection in the U.S., a country that for decades prosecuted dissenters. What caused the radical turnaround by the Supreme Court to support free speech? Then, in commemoration of the 50th anniversary of John F. Kennedy's assassination, we revisit a discussion with Kennedy's special counsel, Ted Sorensen. Joining us now is Thomas Healy, professor of law at Seton Hall Law School and author of The Great Dissent, How Oliver Wendell Holmes Changed His Mind and Changed the History of Free Speech in America. His book traces where the shift in U.S. law and culture began to form from prosecuting dissenters to protecting free speech. Welcome back, Thomas Healy.
Thank you.
Last week, we were discussing how for decades the U.S. had been prosecuting dissent. Supreme Court has been siding with the U.S. government, upholding the prosecutions. But things began to change because of Oliver Wendell Holmes' encounters with a handful of people. We talked about Billings' learned hand, and then we just started to talk about this young man, Harold Laski, and the impact that he made on him. Let's review what the times were like.
Sure. This is all taking place in 1918, 1919, the end of World War I, the beginning of the first Red Scare. During World War I, the government had pretty vigorously prosecuted dissent under the Espionage and Sedition Acts, which essentially made it a crime to say almost anything critical of the government or the war. Nearly 2,000 indictments were brought under the two laws. You had people going to jail for 5, 10, 15, 20 years. Including Eugene Debs, who was the leader of the Socialist Party at the time. And the lower courts had, for the most part, been upholding these convictions. And there were a number of cases that came before the Supreme Court in the spring of 1919, and the Supreme Court also upheld the convictions in opinions written by Holmes. And the court had some more cases that it was facing in the fall of 1919 that were sort of left over from the war. These were appeals from convictions that were brought during the war. But during 1919, the first Red Scare is underway, and this sort of fear has been transformed from a fear of German spies or sympathizers into a fear of Bolshevists. And so Congress is launching investigations. The Attorney General is trying to stamp out dissent. A young individual in the Department of Justice by the name of J. Edgar Hoover is beginning to catalog or to compile lists of people who are viewed as subversive. And it's in this context that some progressives are starting to make more vocal arguments in favor of free speech.
And so last week we talked about this chance encounter with the state judge, Billings' learned hand, and then Harold Laski, and they were starting to try to persuade Oliver Wendell Holmes that his position up until this point had perhaps not been the correct position on speech.
Absolutely. So Holmes ran into Hand on a train between New York and Boston in the summer of 1918, and Hand had launched into a speech about the value of tolerance, to which Holmes had replied that Hand was striking at the sacred right to kill the other fellow when he disagrees. Hand is shocked into silence and begins this correspondence with Holmes in which he is trying to make him more sensitive to the value of free speech and the value of tolerance. And then some other individuals get in on this lobbying effort. And foremost among them is Harold Laski, who was at the time a young 24-year-old political theorist and economist who was from England but was an instructor at Harvard. And he had met Holmes through one of his colleagues at Harvard, a professor at the law school named Felix Frankfurter, who, of course, went on to sit on the Supreme Court in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s. And both Laski and Frankfurter were connected to a magazine called The New Republic, which was new at the time, had been founded in 1914. Learned Hand had connections to The New Republic. And both Frankfurter and Laski were also connected to a house in Washington, D.C. that was known as the House of Truth. This was a house in DuPont Circle that served as a kind of literary or legal salon It was a gathering place for young journalists and diplomats and lawyers in Washington. And it was at this house and through these individuals that, Lasky and Frankfurter became friends with Holmes. And so Lasky and Frankfurter, really of all these individuals, are the two that are the closest to Holmes. And Holmes has almost a paternal relationship with these two, especially with Lasky, who had been essentially sort of abandoned by his family, or his family had renounced him because he had married a Gentile. Lasky was Jewish. And so Lasky sort of had this kind of gap in his life. He needed a father figure. And Holmes didn't have any children and viewed Lasky as a son. And so they became very close very quickly, primarily through letters, but then in the summer, when Holmes would vacation or spend his summer recess in on the North Shore of Boston, Lasky would also spend the summer just up the coast in Rockport, and the two would spend a lot of time together in the summer. And that began in the summer of 1918, and it continued through the summer of 1919.
Let's talk about some of the cases. Up until these encounters, and even up until the Abrams case, Holmes had been supporting the juries that had been convicting people who were dissenting against the government. Now, Learned Hand had a case in which he made this argument, the Masses case.
Yes.
And he made this argument about speech to Oliver Wendell Holmes in the encounter and in some letters following. But Oliver Wendell Holmes' position in these other cases, what were these cases and what did he say?
Well, these were cases in which socialists, they were almost all socialists, and a fair number of them were German socialists who, you know, were suspected of having some sympathies with the German cause. These individuals had criticized the war, had argued, as most socialists did, that the war was being fought for the benefit of Wall Street, and that, you know, the working class was being sent off to die so that the wealthy plutocrats could benefit. And in the Schenck case, they had these were some socialists in Philadelphia who had printed up some flyers and distributed them, and had essentially urged people to exercise their right to claim conscientious objector status to the draft. They had circulated these pamphlets. They made them available at their bookstore downtown, and they had actually mailed some of them to draftees, to men who had been drafted. And when officials became aware of this, they raided their offices. They seized these flyers, and they charged them with violating the Espionage Act. Eugene Debs was one of the cases. He had given a speech in Canton, Ohio, that was, you know, basically a stump speech in advance of the fall 1918 midterm elections. And he had made similar arguments about how the war was being fought for the bankers and the working man was being sent off to die. And in a case called Froework, this involved an editor of a German language newspaper in Kansas City who had written editorials that were critical of the war. And all of these individuals were prosecuted. They got, some of them got 5-10 years in jail for engaging in this speech. And when these cases came before the Supreme Court in the spring of 1919, the court voted unanimously to uphold the convictions. And Holmes wrote the opinions. And consistent with his beliefs up to this point, he rejected their free speech claims. He said in a passage that has become famous, he said that free speech doesn't protect a person in falsely shouting fire in a crowded theater, and analogized what these individuals were doing to falsely shouting fire in a crowded theater. He also did something in the Schenck case which was interesting. Prior to that point, most courts had analyzed these free speech claims under a test that was known as the bad tendency test, which meant that if your speech had any tendency to cause any sort of harm, it could be punished. Holmes actually articulated a slightly different test. He said that the test was whether or not the speech posed a clear and present danger. This was completely novel formulation. Those words had never appeared in that form before. And on their face, they sound like they're quite speech protective. Like, in order to be punished, the danger has to be clear, it can't be speculative, and it has to be present, meaning immediate. It can't be some remote danger in the future. But Holmes, after stating that test, he didn't apply it to the facts of any of these cases. He just affirmed the convictions, which was kind of puzzling. And as soon as these decisions come down, he gets inundated with letters of criticism about the decisions, and his friends start to sort of push him as well. He gets a letter from Learned Hand, who takes issue with the way Holmes formulates the test. He gets a letter from Harold Lasky, who is also concerned about the amount of discretion that Holmes is giving the government in punishing people who criticize the war. And you start to see Holmes beginning to get a little defensive and to try to distance himself a little bit from these decisions and his responses to Lasky and Hand and to others of his friends. He writes off a series of letters to various friends defending his decisions, but at the same time trying to distance himself a little bit from those decisions and saying that he would support a pardon, you know, if Wilson wants to pardon Debs, that would be a good thing. And so you start to see Holmes moving a little bit in the direction of free speech after these decisions in the spring of 1919.
Now, Louis Brandeis, who was also a justice who came onto the court, had also begun to lobby and discuss cases with Oliver Wendell Holmes. What impact do you think Justice Brandeis had on him?
Well, Brandeis definitely had a lot of influence on Holmes in general. They actually knew each other from years before. They had both attended Harvard Law School, although not at the same time. Brandeis was younger than Holmes. But after Brandeis got to Cambridge and enrolled at Harvard Law School, he met Holmes, and the two became friends in Boston. Their careers diverged at a certain point. Holmes sat on the Massachusetts Supreme Court, while Brandeis went into private practice and became quite successful and quite rich. But when Brandeis was appointed to the Supreme Court in 1916, the two quickly renewed their friendship. And Holmes had a lot of admiration for Brandeis. He thought he was incredibly smart, and he liked the fact that Brandeis was open to larger ideas and theories in a way that he felt the other justices on the Supreme Court weren't at that time. And so Brandeis, who was quite progressive and liberal at the time, he starts nudging Holmes to the left on various issues, and he does this with respect to free speech. There are two decisions, actually, or two dissenting opinions that Holmes writes in 1918 that aren't directly about free speech. They're sort of tangentially related, but he writes these opinions because of pressure that he comes under from Brandeis. He actually tells Harold Lasky in a letter that he was, and he uses the word cat-spawned, that he was cat-spawned by Brandeis into writing a dissent on burning themes. And he's referring there to a dissenting opinion he writes in the winter of 1918, the fall of 1918. And so Brandeis is sort of pushing Holmes a little bit, although Brandeis's views at the time were not on free speech, were not fully formed. He actually joins the court's opinions in the spring of 1919 that uphold these convictions. And Brandeis is also preoccupied at the time with the Zionist movement. He spends the summer of 1919 in Europe and in Israel, or what later becomes Israel. And so he has some influence on Holmes, but I don't think he has as much influence as people like Lasky and Hand do. And what Lasky does is to really sort of lead this effort. He feeds Holmes one book after another on tolerance and political liberalism. He sends Holmes a book that's a biography of Adam Smith, who was the founder of laissez-faire capitalism and the idea of free trade, which comes out in Holmes's Abrams dissent when he talks about the free trade and ideas. Lasky sends Holmes articles that are written in the Harvard Law Review and the New Republic arguing for an expansive view of free speech. And he even does something that, you know, by today's sort of judicial standards of ethics would, I think, be considered quite questionable. In the summer of 1919, he arranges a meeting between Holmes and a young professor at Harvard Law School by the name of Zachariah Chafee, who was an emerging free speech scholar and had criticized Holmes' decision in the Debs case. And Lasky invites the two men to his bungalow in Rockport during the summer to have tea and to meet and to talk about these issues. And before the meeting, he writes Chafee, and he says that he's given Holmes Chafee's article, and he says, "We must fight on it. I'll go to the stake for every word." So there's a sense in which he really is, trying to make a real concerted effort to change Holmes' views on free speech.
Let me just remind listeners that you're listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're speaking with Thomas Healy about his new book, The Great Dissent, How Oliver Wendell Holmes Changed His Mind and Changed the History of Free Speech in America. Fast forward now to the Abrams case, because this is where he takes his old phrase, the clear and present danger that he used in Schenck, and kind of turned it around to be a pro-free speech phrase. What happened?
Well, you're absolutely right that clear and present danger, in the earlier cases, hadn't really meant much because Holmes hadn't applied it. A legal test is only as strong as the application of it, and Holmes hadn't applied it. But what happened is, after those cases came out in the spring of 1919, Zachariah Chafee, this professor at Harvard Law School, is writing a law review article about free speech and about these cases. And he's looking for a way to argue for a speech protective test. And he's reading these opinions, and he starts thinking about that phrase, clear and present danger. And he starts realizing that, actually, if that phrase is applied, that it could be a very speech protective test. And so that's what he argues for in his article that summer in the Harvard Law Review. And he sort of makes a claim that's kind of disingenuous. He makes the claim that, in fact, the court has already embraced a speech protective test. That this test that Holmes announced, that's a great test, and that the court has already sort of embraced it. When in fact Holmes had just sort of tossed it off, kind of casually, almost cavalierly. But Chafee's smart, and he realizes that he can make something of this. And Learned Hand recognizes what he's doing. Hand writes to him later and says that, Chafee has taken what has fallen from heaven and treated it like manna. And, so basically took advantage of this phrase. And so then, over tea, I think Chafee is trying to encourage Holmes to treat this phrase seriously and, to actually give it some real teeth. And so that's sort of what sets the stage for the Abrams case in the fall of 1919. This is a case that is, in some ways similar to the earlier cases. The defendants are a group of Russian immigrants who are active in the anarchist community that was quite vibrant at the time in New York City. And they had circulated some flyers that did not criticize the war against Germany. What they criticized was the Wilson administration's intervention in the Russian Revolution. And the Wilson administration had sent troops into Russia, and these Russian immigrants thought that these troops were being sent to crush the revolution. And so they argued that Wilson was a hypocrite and a liar and a coward, and that this was going to, end up destroying this revolution. And they encouraged workers in the munitions factories in New York City to go on strike. Now, of course, a strike in the munitions factories would not only affect military intervention in Russia, it would have consequences for the war against Germany. And so they were prosecuted under the Sedition Act. There was a provision in there about how you couldn't encourage or hinder the production of any sort of munitions that were necessary for the war. And so they were prosecuted, and they were sentenced to 20 years in jail, or at least most of them were. And this case came before the Supreme Court in the fall of 1919. Now, to most members of the court, this case was no different than the earlier cases. A majority of the court upholds the convictions. 7 members of the court uphold the convictions, citing Holmes's opinions from earlier in the year. But Holmes writes a dissenting opinion, and it's joined by Brandeis. And what's really interesting about this dissenting opinion is that you can see in this dissent the influence of this sort of behind-the-scenes lobbying effort over the past year by Holmes's friends to change his mind. But there's something else that's going on here behind the scenes as well. And I think it's important to understand that, because I think it really makes clear that this dissenting opinion that Holmes writes is not just a kind of academic exercise, but it has a real personal component. During the year 1919, during the Red Scare, two of Holmes's friends, Lasky and Frankfurter, they came under attack for their own somewhat radical views. Lasky for his Marxist leanings, and Frankfurter for his support of labor unions. And both men who taught at Harvard, and Harvard was in the midst of a fundraising campaign, and the conservative alumni at Harvard were upset about the activities of these two men and threatened to withhold their contributions if the two men weren't fired. And Holmes found out about this, and in the spring of 1919, he wrote letters on their behalf to the Harvard president and to the Harvard Law School Alumni Association, and that seemed to help. But in the fall of 1919, Lasky came under attack again because when the Boston police went on strike, Lasky came out in support of them, and the Harvard Board of Trustees launched an investigation to determine whether he was fit to remain on the faculty. And so at the very moment that the court is considering, you know, the scope of free speech, the ability of people to engage in dissent, one of Holmes's very close friends, an individual that he viewed as a sort of son, is under attack for his own, you know, dissenting opinions. And in fact, the very week that the court hears arguments in this Abrams opinion, Frankfurter pays a visit to the editor of the Atlantic Monthly magazine and is furious about the attacks on Lasky and the general attitude of intolerance in the country. And the editor of the Atlantic tells Frankfurter that he will print an article on tolerance if Frankfurter can get one from someone like Holmes, or he refers to Charles Eliot, who was the former president of Harvard. He said, somebody who counts. And what he meant by that is a member of the establishment, a member of the old guard, someone who people will listen to. So Frankfurter passes that information on to Lasky, and both of these men write letters to Holmes the very week that the Abrams case is being argued, and they ask Holmes if he will write an article like this on tolerance. Now, Holmes declines. It was a sort of odd request, you know, to ask a justice of the Supreme Court to write an article for a magazine about tolerance. He declines, but he makes clear that he's troubled by the attacks on Lasky and that he's not afraid to speak his mind. And then he writes the dissent in Abrams, and he tells Frankfurter in a letter that he wrote the dissent quasi in furor, which is Latin for as if possessed. And when the dissent comes out, his friends, Lasky, Frankfurter, Walter Lippmann, Herbert Crowley, Roscoe Pound, the dean of Harvard Law School, Learned Hand, they all write him these letters that are incredibly, they're filled with, you know, incredible gratitude, and they're incredibly poignant letters telling Holmes, you know, how grateful they are for what he has done. And the implication is that he's done something for them. So I think what's really interesting about this dissenting opinion is Holmes is writing it technically in defense of these Russian immigrants, but from the perspective of his friends, they viewed it as a defense of them. So you have this, you know, this incredibly influential Supreme Court opinion that really, I think, is motivated in part by very personal considerations.
Thomas Healy, two things I'd like to end on. One is, how long did it take before protecting speech went from being a dissent to then being the law based on, essentially, Oliver Wendell Holmes' dissent as the starting point? But then also, how much do you think this story tells us about the making of law?
Well, the path from this dissent of Holmes, and it is a dissent, right? He doesn't make the law in this with this dissenting opinion.
Exactly.
You know, he introduces the notion of the marketplace of ideas. He gives some real bite to this notion of clear and present danger, but he's in dissent. You know, that's not the law of the land at the time. And it takes quite a while for these views to become the majority view. Holmes and Brandeis, they continue to dissent in a number of cases over the next decade. They continue to insist that clear and present danger, as they understand it, is the applicable test, and that if speech should not be punished unless it poses, you know, a clear and present danger, that we should rely on the marketplace of ideas, that the remedy for speech that you disagree with is not censorship, it's more speech. You know, if you don't like what somebody says, then respond to that with more speech. And so they continue to dissent, and very powerful language over the next decade. And you gradually see the court becoming more responsive and receptive to these ideas. And it's really in the late 1930s, early 1940s, that the court embraces clear and present danger. But even then, we go through some later struggles with free speech. Obviously, during the Cold War and McCarthyism, the court backslides a little bit. And it's really not until the late 1960s, in a case called Brandenburg, where the court finally sort of embraces the strong version of the clear and present danger test. They call it, they use different words for it by this time, but it really is Holmes's test made even stronger. And so, you know, as a kind of legal matter, it takes, basically 50 years until this is the law of the land as far as the Supreme Court is concerned. I think in the culture, I think, these ideas, they make some headway earlier, and then, of course, there's some backsliding during McCarthyism. But these ideas of, the marketplace of ideas and the free trade in ideas and clear and present danger, these are not just legal concepts. They are, for us now, part of our cultural vocabulary. They're part of the way we think about ourselves, and they're part of our identity as a nation.
You look at this story, what do we draw from this in terms of the making of law? This story is partly about friendship.
I think it's a huge part of the story is about friendship and about relationships. I think that there's certainly an intellectual component to this lobbying campaign. And they are certainly, these friends of Holmes are certainly appealing to him, on an intellectual level. But it seems to me that it's really only when these issues become very personal and concrete to Holmes that he is ready to fully embrace these ideas.
So could it happen again in another decade with a Roberts Court justice, for example?
I mean, I think it can. I think that, one of the major points that Holmes made throughout his career was about how law is made. A famous line from one of Holmes's books is that the life of the law has not been logic, it has been experience. And what he meant by that is that, we don't make the law, courts don't make the law strictly as a logical matter, that judges are influenced by all sorts of other factors, including, the prejudices that they share with their fellow men, including, their biases and the people they know. And I think that this experience that Holmes goes through is a perfect illustration of that. And I think it happens all the time. I think that, there are justices on the Supreme Court now who acknowledge that their views on various issues, such as, say, same-sex marriage, are at least partially influenced by the fact that they know people who are gay, and that matters to them. And I think it's inescapable. I think that anybody who tries to claim that judges decide cases in a vacuum and that their personal background and experiences and relationships don't play a role, I think those people are kidding themselves. And so, yes, I think it is possible that, in some way that we may never be aware of, current and future justices could be influenced in ways similar to how Holmes was influenced.
The book, again, is called The Great Dissent, How Oliver Wendell Holmes Changed His Mind and Changed the History of Free Speech in America. We've been speaking with Thomas Healy, the author of the book. Thank you so much, Thomas Healy.
Thank you, Maria.
In commemoration of the 50th anniversary of John F. Kennedy's assassination, we revisit a discussion with Kennedy's special counsel, Ted Sorensen. Stay tuned. Thank you. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org, and I'm Maria Armudian. Ted Sorensen was 24 when he began working for then-freshman Senator John F. Kennedy. But in time, he became Kennedy's special counsel, his closest advisor and speechwriter. Kennedy once referred to him as his intellectual blood bank, and no one other than Robert F. Kennedy had more access to the president. Sorensen co-authored Kennedy's Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Profiles in Courage, and wrote 9 books of his own, including Counselor, Life at the Edge of History. We spoke with Ted Sorensen in 2008. He passed away in 2010. Welcome, Ted Sorensen.
Thank you. I'm happy to be with you.
So I'd like to start with your personal politics. You wrote that you actually had no interest in politics until you were 4 years old.
That's right. That's when my father introduced my two older brothers and me from a county fair platform where he was engaged in politicking in his race for re-election as Attorney General of Nebraska.
And you are a Unitarian and a conscientious objector and committed to civil rights before it really was a major issue.
Well, it was a major issue with me and my family because we saw no reason whatsoever why the color of someone's skin should affect their rights and opportunities in a free country.
But you said you were hardly a revolutionary.
No, we didn't to go out and march and carry banners and shout, but we found other ways to work quietly through organizations, using words in speeches, articles, and otherwise.
Your politics were not necessarily a perfect match with John F. Kennedy. He wasn't a pacifist, and he wasn't as concerned with civil rights early on.
Not initially, he wasn't. And as far as military goes, he pointed out in his American University speech, this generation of Americans has had enough of war. Yes, he was a war hero and saw two of his best friends killed in war, and he was not willing to send other young Americans off to war unless they had tried every diplomatic remedy first. And he did not believe that political problems could be solved by military remedies.
You mentioned that even Eisenhower, a major war hero, also made that ultimate decision in the end.
That's right. His son, John, quoted him as having renounced war and weapons of mass destruction as a means of solving world problems after his experience in World War II.
So here you were. You had worked for a committee for a bit, and then you were interviewing with some senators, and you interviewed with John F. Kennedy, then a freshman senator. Some people thought he was a dilettante. He had a poor attendance record. His commitments were kind of vague, but you chose him. Why?
I found him very impressive, but my senior mentors who knew Washington a lot better than I did, they were not impressed, and they advised me that he was more of a dilettante and that he was conservative and had an absentee record, which was due to his health, and therefore I should accept the other offer made to me at the same time, which was from Senator Scoop Jackson of the state of Washington. But I had been more impressed by Kennedy. I went back to re-interview with both of them, and in those re-interviews, it became very clear that working for Kennedy would be more challenging, more interesting, more substantive, and then working for Jackson.
And when you describe him, you say he was this person who had this extraordinary background, but he was not the, quote, Camelot myth that described him as too heroic to be human.
Well, that's exactly right. He didn't try to overwhelm me in that first meeting by how important he was, as politicians often do. He wasn't flashy. He was just a good guy, a young man with a good smile and a sense of humor, with a bad back like a lot of other young and middle-aged men. I just decided this was somebody I could get along with very well, and that's the way it turned out for 11 years.
And unlike a lot of other politicians, you said he was kind of calm and self-effacing.
He was always calm and cool, and he loved to laugh, and that included laughing at himself.
There were a lot of things you said about him that I thought were particularly remarkable, like the strong reluctance he had to fire people and instead promoting them.
Unfortunately, that's true. That's how we got a couple ambassadors and federal judges, I regret to say, but sometimes a kind heart can be too kind, I suppose.
So you think that's what it was? It was just a kind heart?
He didn't like firing people.
And in terms of the big issues that you were involved in, you focused on the Cuban Missile Crisis and the civil rights initiatives. I thought we should talk a bit about the Cuban Missile Crisis because it was a huge potential disaster that was averted. Tell us what was going on behind the scenes.
The Cuban Missile Crisis occurred at the darkest point in the Cold War between the Soviet Union and the United States. The Soviet Union, with its communist allies, hoping to spread their system throughout the world, and the United States and its Western allies determined to prevent the defeat of democracy through Soviet expansion. Both sides had built up these enormous stockpiles of nuclear weapons, and in October 1962, for the first time in history, the Soviet Union swiftly and secretly moved nuclear missiles outside its own borders and placed them in the island of Cuba, 90 miles from our shores. Kennedy knew the United States could not simply accept that if our allies were ever to have any confidence in our resolve. And so he summoned a group of which I was one to formulate a response, and he insisted on knowing from us all the possible options that he had: military, diplomatic, combination military, diplomatic, multilateral, unilateral, and he also wanted to know the pros and cons of each one of those options. So different from invading Iraq without asking what options the United States had to get rid of Saddam Hussein.
How did those conversations go? I can imagine that it was extraordinarily intense. Here he is, the President of the United States and his closest group of advisors, seriously looking down the nose at some missiles being placed 90 miles away.
I'm afraid that's right. We knew that if we didn't come up with the right response, if we were too belligerent, too aggressive, and started World War III, the world might never recover. If, on the other hand, we were too weak, too submissive, and our allies lost confidence in us, that might lead to the breakup of the alliance, and we would face a difficult, dangerous world all by ourselves.
Within that circle, did anybody want to go completely offensive?
Oh, absolutely. There were what later were called hawks, including the military, most of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and some other conservatives in our group. One of them said, "This is your excuse, your opportunity, Mr. President, to go in there and take Cuba away from Castro." And even at the darkest moments during those 13 days that historians now call the most dangerous 13 days in the history of mankind, even then the Joint Chiefs were calling on us to bomb the missile sites and follow up the bombing with an invasion. We subsequently learned, had we done that, we didn't know it at the time, there were Soviet troops on the island equipped with tactical nuclear weapons and the authority to use them on their own initiative in the event of an American attack. So World War III and a nuclear exchange would have been started had some other president been in charge, because Kennedy kept resisting the advice of those who wanted to take that kind of belligerent approach. And let's face it, had the Soviet Union launched even tactical nuclear weapons at the United States under the so-called rules of engagement that prevailed in those mad times, the United States would have responded with nuclear weapons. And once both sides get on the nuclear escalator, we soon would have gone from tactical weapons to an exchange of strategic weapons until nothing was left of either country, and the radioactive fallout from those nuclear explosions would be spread by wind and water to the far reaches of the planet, and very little would have been left except a nuclear desert.
You were one of the people who had the most influence on John F. Kennedy.
I had some influence, and Robert Kennedy and I joined in urging that the so-called blockade or quarantine of quarantine against offensive weapons on Cuba be substituted for any idea of bombing or invasion. And ultimately, that sent the right signal to Khrushchev that we were determined upon the withdrawal of those missiles, but that we were not going to launch war to do it. And finally, as spelled out in more detail in the book, we had an exchange of letters with Khrushchev, in which I played a role, and in which Bobby played a role in adding oral messages to those written messages, and Khrushchev decided that he had made a mistake, that what he later called a reckless gamble had misfired, and at the end of those 13 days, he announced publicly, in order to get the message out right away before we did anything, he announced publicly that he was taking the missiles out of Cuba under United Nations inspection. So I think when that happened, Kennedy told our group, I don't want any gloating. I'm going to issue a public statement commending Soviet Chairman Khrushchev for his statesmanship.
Now, you did not write about the Bay of Pigs invasion. And this is something that scholars have looked at, and they thought it was partly a result of groupthink. Schlesinger had objected strongly, but not really strongly enough to stop the invasion. What really happened
there?
Well,
with all due respect to Arthur, my wonderful friend whom we lost, he was not part of the decision-making group. And when JFK found that the generals and admirals and intelligence agency officials that he had inherited from Eisenhower were assuring him that the Bay of Pigs would definitely succeed, that no one would ever know that the United States had any link to it, that there would be an uprising of the Cuban people to throw Castro out as soon as these exiles landed. He believed those assurances and later cursed himself for believing them.
Were there people on his staff that were saying this is just not going to work, or did people really go quiet in the way that the scholars recount it?
The real problem, as I think I mentioned in the book, is that the procedure for decision-making on this matter was completely different from what it was on the Cuban Missile Crisis. This one was held so tightly that around the table were only those holdovers who were involved in planning the Bay of Pigs. And the secrecy was so tight that others of us knew nothing about it. And it's interesting that after the fiasco was over, JFK, number one, once he was found himself in that hole, he didn't dig it any deeper, making it worse the way the CIA wanted him to do. Number two, he learned his lessons and he changed personnel, he changed decision-making procedures, he changed policies. And number three, this is a little immodest on my part, he asked his brother, Robert Kennedy, the Attorney General, and me thereafter to sit in on National Security Council meetings, not because either Bobby or I were experts in national security affairs, but because he knew we were skeptics who looked at proposals and plans with his eyes, keeping in mind his interests and the country's interests, and not simply the interests of a particular department or agency. So in that sense, the terrible consequences of the Bay of Pigs were a blessing, because when a much worse crisis confronted us a year and a half later at the Cuban Missile Crisis, Kennedy this time knew how to proceed, and he proceeded successfully.
Just a reminder that you're listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're speaking with Kennedy's special counsel and special advisor, Ted Sorensen. We conducted the interview in 2008. Ted Sorensen died in 2010. Let's move to the civil rights initiatives. One of the things that I thought was interesting was how every political person in the South supported segregation. JFK and RFK, you said, were slow to recognize the moral imperative. So what happened?
What happened was that both JFK and RFK, as they became more exposed to problems and people that they had never encountered in their privileged youth, began to understand the moral dimensions, even to compare it with the discrimination against Irish Catholics that faced early immigrants to this country. And as young people inspired by JFK's own words, particularly in his inaugural address, began the so-called freedom rides into the South, testing the desegregation of interstate transportation. And as civil rights groups composed of both black and white citizens began protesting the laws and orders, and as the federal courts began to order the admission to Southern universities of qualified black students, the Kennedy brothers, especially John F. Kennedy as president, recognized that, number one, it was the president's obligation under the Constitution to carry out the orders of the court, and number two, that these fires, theoretical, not actual in all, most cases, fires burning across the country were fires of inspiration and calling for equality, calling for a recognition of the rights of all Americans, regardless of color. And as JFK said in his speech to the country and the world on June 11, 1963, it was a moral issue, an issue that had its roots in the Bible and its legal roots in the Constitution.
There was a point in time when you debated certain actions that related to civil rights. You both thought it was, as you said, morally permissible to compromise on some of these for the long-term strategic goals. In this particular case, it was while he was running for president against Nixon.
Well, what I was talking about, compromises on timing, perhaps on emphasis. But even in that campaign of 1960, when Nixon had a so-called Southern strategy in which appeals would be made to white segregationists in the South to support the Republicans because they had more to fear from the Democrats, Kennedy ran on a Democratic National Convention platform that called flat out for civil rights and equal opportunities. He talked about it in his campaign, deploring, for example, the absence of blacks in the U.S. Foreign Service and among our ambassadorial ranks. Even on his first hours in office watching the inaugural parade, he noticed there were no blacks marching in the Coast Guard unit and immediately called to find out why that was true and how it could be changed. But after he settled into office and his congressional leaders told him that the last attempt to get a civil rights bill through Congress had failed, even when there were 23 more liberal Democrats from the North in the Congress than there were in 1961, and therefore that if Kennedy tried again to send civil rights legislation to Congress, it would simply be a symbolic but futile gesture. Not only could it not pass, but it would cause the Southern Democrats in both the House and the Senate to come down hard against the rest of his legislative program, which included increasing the minimum wage, increasing help for public housing, increasing assistance to economically distressed urban areas. All that legislation was a lot more important to our black citizens than symbolic efforts and defeat on the floor, so Kennedy compromised and did not send that legislation up in his first 2 years in the White House.
So this actually illustrates how complex these political decisions can be. I wonder if you think there are comparable issues that we face today.
Oh, I suppose presidents face choices all the time that are difficult, that require compromise in order to get something passed. Kennedy used to quote the old saying, the perfect is the enemy of the good, because if you keep insisting on the perfect, you may defeat everything and therefore prevent the good from being enacted.
Right.
And we have that now on national national security issues, I'm sure, where there are those who would want to have a police state as a means of keeping out possibly dangerous people from other countries, covering what they are talking about on their telephones, of uncovering what they're communicating about in the mails. So national security often requires infringements of civil liberties, and I am in favor of a president who recognizes that infringement of civil liberties is simply imitating the enemy and thereby losing. And we want to keep America strong by keeping its values intact.
What I wanted to do was take the period from the time JFK died when he was shot up until today, which was a period you had President Johnson transitioning. We had President Carter coming in. You talked a little bit about them. But one of the things that I gathered from this, what you call the dumbing down of America, of the press, and the changes in politics itself, people not wanting to engage as much in running for office.
Yes, it's politics has been a sorry spectacle in this country since both Kennedy brothers were killed, John F. in 1963, Robert Kennedy in 1968. Since then, politics has been full of angry partisan accusations. But when we get presidents who are unwilling or unable to live up to the kinds of standards that John F. Kennedy established, then the press has not fulfilled its role of holding the President of the United States accountable for his failures and mistakes. Even the party, speaking of my own party, the Democrats, has too often failed to press for the high ideals that Kennedy set for the party and the country. Even when it had control of the Congress, it too often failed to block tragic errors like the unilateral invasion of Iraq, the militarization of space, the continued decline of equal opportunities in too many parts of this country. Whether it's dumbing down or simply the skill and success of those on the far right to warn Americans and frighten Americans, and the politics of fear has enabled them to attack anyone who's for peace and cooperation and international understanding, saying they're naive and unrealistic and all the things we're hearing even these days. Two men I've never heard of, nobody's ever heard of, have an op-ed piece in the New York Times in which they say, no, sometimes you should fear to negotiate. Sometimes it's better not to meet with your adversary. Mr. Obama should learn that when Kennedy met with Khrushchev, Khrushchev pummeled him. Khrushchev beat up on him. Kennedy appeared weak, and that led to Khrushchev taking even more actions against the United States. Every word of that is untrue. I have studied with great care the transcript of the dialogue between Kennedy and Khrushchev in Vienna in 1961. Each one of them gave as well as he got. There was no pummeling. In fact, Mr. Khrushchev told his son when he got home to Moscow that Mr. Kennedy was a very worthy adversary, a very strong and articulate spokesman for the Western view. And after Kennedy had a very gracious meeting with Khrushchev's editor's son-in-law, Azubay, they, meaning Kennedy and Khrushchev, began a secret back-channel correspondence which went a long way to keeping the lid on the Cold War and preventing a sudden crisis in Berlin. So these two gentlemen are distorting history in order to try to attack Barack Obama, because Obama said he is willing to communicate with those who don't like us, whether in Iran or Syria or elsewhere in the world.
Finally, about speech and Barack Obama, one of the criticisms about Obama is that he is very eloquent, and perhaps they are suggesting that he is not substantive. You seem to indicate, and you were a speechwriter as well as an advisor at the Corps, do you think that speeches from politicians are very important in the grand scheme of things?
Not only speeches, declarations, proclamations, legislative messages. What has been dismissed by some as just words is how a president functions. That's how Kennedy persuaded the Soviets to pull their missiles out of Cuba. That's how Kennedy turned this country around on the civil rights issue. That's how Kennedy galvanized the U.S. space effort by promising to send a man to the moon in a decade. And in one accomplishment after another, Kennedy's words, his messages, his speeches were the essential part of his appeal to Americans and, above all, to the rest of the world. Kennedy believed in the importance of world opinion, and as a result, we gained respect for this country and appreciation of our values, and that made us a whole lot safer from hatred and attack abroad than we are today.
Well, Ted Sorensen, thank you so very much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
That was Ted Sorensen, who was John F. Kennedy's speechwriter, special counsel, and special advisor. We conducted the interview in 2008. Ted Sorensen died in 2010. That is it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests. An extra special thanks to Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, and Huatemoc Aileman, who produced this show each week. And to Sud Dongre and iConnect, our webmaster and web host. Most of all, thank you for listening. And if you missed any part of the show, you can go to scholarcircle.org or armudian.com or kpfk.org. You can also hear us on Stitcher, on iTunes. You can like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at armudian. See you next week.